Preface. Many histories of philosophy exist, and it has not been my purpose merely to add one to their number. My purpose is to exhibit philosophy as an integral part of social and political life, not as the isolated speculations of remarkable individuals, but as both an effect and a cause of the character of the various communities in which different systems flourished. This purpose demands more account of general history than is usually given by historians of philosophy. I have found this particularly necessary as regards periods with which the general reader cannot be assumed to be familiar. The great age of the scholastic philosophy was an outcome of the reforms of the 11th century, and these, in turn, were a reaction against previous corruption. Without some knowledge of the centuries between the fall of Rome and the rise of the medieval papacy, the intellectual atmosphere of the 12th and 13th centuries can hardly be understood. In dealing with this period, as with others, I have aimed at giving only so much general history as I thought necessary for the sympathetic comprehension of philosophers in relation to the times that formed them and the times that they helped to form. One consequence of this point of view is that the importance which it gives to a philosopher is often not that which he deserves on account of his philosophic merit. For my part, for example, I consider Spinoza a greater philosopher than Locke, but he was far less influential. I have therefore treated him much more briefly than Locke. Some men, for example, Rousseau and Byron, though not philosophers at all in the academic sense, have so profoundly affected the prevailing philosophic temper that the development of philosophy cannot be understood if they are ignored. Even pure men of action are sometimes of great importance in this respect. Very few philosophers have influenced philosophy as much as Alexander the Great, Charlemagne, or Napoleon. Lycurgus, if only he had existed, would have been a still more notable example. In attempting to cover such a vast stretch of time, it is necessary to have very drastic principles of selection. I have come to the conclusion from reading standard histories of philosophy that very short accounts convey nothing of value to the reader. I have therefore omitted altogether, with few exceptions, men who did not seem to me to deserve a fairly full treatment. In the case of the men whom I have discussed, I have mentioned what seemed relevant as regards their lives and their social surroundings. I have even sometimes recorded intrinsically unimportant details when I considered them illustrative of a man or of his times. Finally, I owe a word of explanation and apology to specialists on any part of my enormous subject. It is obviously impossible to know as much about every philosopher as can be known about him by a man whose field is less wide. I have no doubt that every single philosopher whom I have mentioned, with the exception of Leibniz, is better known to many men than to me. If, however, this were considered a sufficient reason for respectful silence, it would follow that no man should undertake to treat of more than some narrow strip of history. The influence of Sparta on Rousseau, of Plato on Christian philosophy until the 13th century, of the Nestorians on the Arabs, and thence on Aquinas, of St. Ambrose on liberal political philosophy from the rise of the Lombard cities until the present day, are some among the themes of which only a comprehensive history can treat. On such grounds, I ask the indulgence of those readers who find my knowledge of this or that portion of my subject less adequate than it would have been if there had been no need to remember Time's Winged Chariot. This book owes its existence to Dr. Albert C. Barnes, having been originally designed and partly delivered as lectures at the Barnes Foundation in Pennsylvania. As in most of my work during the last 13 years, I have been greatly assisted in research and in many other ways by my wife, Patricia Russell. Bertrand Russell. Introductory. The conceptions of life and the world which we call philosophical are a product of two factors. One, inherited religious and ethical conceptions, the other the sort of investigation which may be called scientific, using this word in its broadest sense. Individual philosophers have differed widely in regard to the proportions in which these two factors entered into their systems, but it is the presence of both in some degree that characterizes philosophy. Philosophy is a word which has been used in many ways, some wider, some narrower. I propose to use it in a very wide sense, which I will now try to explain. Philosophy, as I shall understand the word, is something intermediate between theology and science. Like theology, it consists of speculations on matters as to which definite knowledge has so far been unascertainable. But like science, it appeals to human reason rather than to authority, whether that of tradition or that of revelation. All definite knowledge, so I should contend, belongs to science. All dogma, as to what surpasses definite knowledge, belongs to theology. But between theology and science, there is a no-man's land, exposed to attack from both sides. This no-man's land is philosophy. Almost all the questions of most interest to speculative minds are such as science cannot answer, and the confident answers of theologians no longer seem so convincing as they did in former centuries. Is the world divided into mind and matter? And if so, what is mind and what is matter? Is mind subject to matter, or is it possessed of independent powers? Has the universe any unity or purpose? Is it evolving towards some goal? Are there really laws of nature, or do we believe in them only because of our innate love of order? Is man what he seems to the astronomer, a tiny lump of impure carbon and water impotently crawling on a small and unimportant planet? Or is he what he appears to Hamlet? Is he perhaps both at once? Is there a way of living that is noble and another that is base, or are all ways of living merely futile? If there is a way of living that is noble, in what does it consist and how shall we achieve it? Must the good be eternal in order to deserve to be valued? Or is it worth seeking even if the universe is inexorably moving towards death? Is there such a thing as wisdom, or is what seems such merely the ultimate refinement of folly? To such questions, no answer can be found in the laboratory. Theologies have professed to give answers, all too definite, but their very definiteness causes modern minds to view them with suspicion. The studying of these questions, if not the answering of them, is the business of philosophy. Why then, you may ask, waste time on such insoluble problems? To this, one may answer as a historian or as an individual facing the terror of cosmic loneliness. The answer of the historian, insofar as I am capable of giving it, will appear in the course of this work. Ever since men became capable of free speculation, their actions, in innumerable important respects, have depended upon their theories as to the world and human life, as to what is good and what is evil. This is as true in the present day as at any former time. To understand an age or a nation, we must understand its philosophy, and to understand its philosophy, we must ourselves be in some degree philosophers. There is here a reciprocal causation. The circumstances of men's lives do much to determine their philosophy, but conversely, their philosophy does much to determine their circumstances. This interaction throughout the centuries will be the topic of the following pages. There is also, however, a more personal answer. Science tells us what we can know, but what we can know is little, and if we forget how much we cannot know, we become insensitive to many things of very great importance. Theology, on the other hand, induces a dogmatic belief that we have knowledge, where in fact we have ignorance, and by doing so generates a kind of impertinent insolence towards the universe. Uncertainty in the presence of vivid hopes and fears is painful, but must be endured if we wish to live without the support of comforting fairy tales. It is not good either to forget the questions that philosophy asks, or to persuade ourselves that we have found indubitable answers to them. To teach how to live without certainty, and yet without being paralyzed by hesitation, is perhaps the chief thing that philosophy in our age can still do for those who study it. Philosophy, as distinct from theology, began in Greece in the 6th century BC. After running its course in antiquity, it was again submerged by theology as Christianity rose and Rome fell. Its second great period, from the 11th to the 14th centuries, was dominated by the Catholic Church, except for a few great rebels, such as the Emperor Frederick II, 1195 to 1250. This period was brought to an end by the confusions that culminated in the Reformation. The third period, from the 17th century to the present day, is dominated more than either of its predecessors by science. Traditional religious beliefs remain important, but are felt to need justification, and are modified wherever science seems to make this imperative. Few of the philosophers of this period are orthodox from a Catholic standpoint, and the secular state is more important in their speculations than the Church. Social cohesion and individual liberty, like religion and science, are in a state of conflict or uneasy compromise throughout the whole period. In Greece, social cohesion was secured by loyalty to the city-state. Even Aristotle, though in his time Alexander was making the city-state obsolete, could see no merit in any other kind of polity. The degree to which the individual's liberty was curtailed by his duty to the city varied widely. In Sparta, he had as little liberty as in modern Germany or Russia. In Athens, in spite of occasional persecutions, citizens had, in the best period, a very extraordinary freedom from restrictions imposed by the state. Greek thought, down to Aristotle, is dominated by religious and patriotic devotion to the city. Its ethical systems are adapted to the lives of citizens and have a large political element. When the Greeks became subject, first to the Macedonians and then to the Romans, the conceptions appropriate to their days of independence were no longer applicable. This produced, on the one hand, a loss of vigor through the breach with tradition, and on the other hand, a more individual and less social ethic. The Stoics thought of the virtuous life as a relation of the soul to God, rather than as a relation of the citizen to the state. They thus prepared the way for Christianity, which, like Stoicism, was originally unpolitical, since during its first 3 centuries its adherents were devoid of influence on government. Social cohesion, during the 6.5 centuries from Alexander to Constantine, was secured not by philosophy and not by ancient loyalties, but by force, first that of armies and then that of civil administration. Roman armies, Roman roads, Roman law, and Roman officials first created and then preserved a powerful centralized state. Nothing was attributable to Roman philosophy since there was none. During this long period, the Greek ideas inherited from the Age of Freedom underwent a gradual process of transformation. Some of the old ideas, notably those which we should regard as specifically religious, gained in relative importance. Others, more rationalistic, were discarded because they no longer suited the spirit of the age. In this way, the later pagans trimmed the Greek tradition until it became suitable for incorporation in Christian doctrine. Christianity popularized an important opinion, already implicit in the teaching of the Stoics, but foreign to the general spirit of antiquity. I mean, the opinion that a man's duty to God is more imperative than his duty to the state. This opinion, that we ought to obey God rather than man, as Socrates and the apostles said, survived the conversion of Constantine because the early Christian emperors were Arians or inclined to Arianism. When the emperors became orthodox, it fell into abeyance. In the Byzantine Empire, it remained latent, as also in the subsequent Russian Empire, which derived its Christianity from Constantinople. Footnote. That is why the modern Russian does not think that we ought to obey dialectical materialism rather than Stalin. End of footnote. But in the West, where the Catholic emperors were almost immediately replaced, except in parts of Gaul, by heretical barbarian conquerors, the superiority of religious to political allegiance survived, and to some extent still survives. The barbarian invasion put an end for 6 centuries to the civilization of Western Europe. It lingered in Ireland until the Danes destroyed it in the 9th century. Before its extinction there, it produced one notable figure, Scotus Origina. In the Eastern Empire, Greek civilization in a desiccated form survived, as in a museum, till the fall of Constantinople in 1453. But nothing of importance to the world came out of Constantinople except an artistic tradition and Justinian's codes of Roman law. During the period of darkness, from the end of the 5th century to the middle of the 11th, the Western Roman world underwent some very interesting changes. The conflict between duty to God and duty to the state, which Christianity had introduced, took the form of a conflict between church and king. The ecclesiastical jurisdiction of the Pope extended over Italy, France and Spain, Great Britain and Ireland, Germany, Scandinavia and Poland. At first, outside Italy and southern France, his control over bishops and abbots was very slight. But from the time of Gregory VII, late 11th century, it became real and effective. From that time on, the clergy throughout Western Europe formed a single organization, directed from Rome, seeking power intelligently and relentlessly, and usually victorious until after the year 1300 in their conflicts with secular rulers. The conflict between church and state was not only a conflict between clergy and laity. It was also a renewal of the conflict between the Mediterranean world and the northern barbarians. The unity of the Church echoed the unity of the Roman Empire. Its liturgy was Latin, and its dominant men were mostly Italian, Spanish, or Southern French. Their education, when education revived, was classical. Their conceptions of law and government would have been more intelligible to Marcus Aurelius than they were to contemporary monarchs. The Church represented at once continuity with the past and what was most civilized in the present. The secular power, on the contrary, was in the hands of kings and barons of Teutonic descent, who endeavored to preserve what they could of the institutions that they had brought out of the forests of Germany. Absolute power was alien to those institutions, and so was what appeared to these vigorous conquerors as a dull and spiritless legality. The king had to share his power with the feudal aristocracy, but all alike expected to be allowed occasional outbursts of passion in the form of war, murder, pillage, or rape. Monarchs might repent, for they were sincerely pious, and after all, repentance was itself a form of passion. But the Church could never produce in them the quiet regularity of good behavior, which a modern employer demands and usually obtains of his employees. What was the use of conquering the world if they could not drink and murder and love as the spirit moved them? And why should they, with their armies of proud knights, submit to the orders of bookish men, vowed to celibacy and destitute of armed force? In spite of ecclesiastical disapproval, they preserved the duel and trial by battle, and they developed tournaments and courtly love. Occasionally, in a fit of rage, they would even murder eminent churchmen. All the armed force was on the side of the kings, and yet the Church was victorious. The Church won, partly because it had almost a monopoly of education, partly because the kings were perpetually at war with each other, but mainly because, with very few exceptions, rulers and people alike profoundly believed that the Church possessed the power of the keys. The Church could decide whether a king should spend eternity in heaven or in hell. The Church could absolve subjects from the duty of allegiance and so stimulate rebellion. The Church, moreover, represented order in place of anarchy, and consequently won the support of the rising mercantile class. In Italy especially, this last consideration was decisive. The Teutonic attempt to preserve at least a partial independence of the Church expressed itself not only in politics, but also in art, romance, chivalry, and war. It expressed itself very little in the intellectual world, because education was almost wholly confined to the clergy. The explicit philosophy of the Middle Ages is not an accurate mirror of the times, but only of what was thought by one party. Among ecclesiastics, however, especially among the Franciscan friars, a certain number, for various reasons, were at variance with the Pope. In Italy, moreover, culture spread to the laity some centuries sooner than it did north of the Alps. Frederick II, who tried to found a new religion, represents the extreme of antipapal culture. Thomas Aquinas, who was born in the kingdom of Naples, where Frederick II was supreme, remains to this day the classic exponent of papal philosophy. Dante, some 50 years later, achieved a synthesis and gave the only balanced exposition of the complete medieval world of ideas. After Dante, both for political and for intellectual reasons, the medieval philosophical synthesis broke down. It had, while it lasted, a quality of tidiness and miniature completeness. Whatever the system took account of was placed with precision with relation to the other contents of its very finite cosmos. But the great schism, the conciliar movement, and the Renaissance papacy led up to the Reformation, which destroyed the unity of Christendom and the scholastic theory of government that centered round the Pope. In the Renaissance period, new knowledge, both of antiquity and of the earth's surface, made men tired of systems which were felt to be mental prisons. The Copernican astronomy assigned to the earth and to man a humbler position than they had enjoyed in the Ptolemaic theory. Pleasure in new facts took the place among intelligent men of pleasure in reasoning, analyzing, and systematizing. Although in art the Renaissance is still orderly, in thought it prefers a large and fruitful disorder. In this respect, Montaigne is the most typical exponent of the age. In the theory of politics, as in everything except art, there was a collapse of order. The Middle Ages, though turbulent in practice, were dominated in thought by a passion for legality and by a very precise theory of political power. All power is ultimately from God. He has delegated power to the Pope in sacred things and to the Emperor in secular matters. But the Pope and Emperor alike lost their importance during the 15th century. The Pope became merely one of the Italian princes, engaged in the incredibly complicated and unscrupulous game of Italian power politics. The new national monarchies in France, Spain, and England had, in their own territories, a power with which neither Pope nor Emperor could interfere. The national state, largely owing to gunpowder, acquired an influence over men's thoughts and feelings which it had not had before, and which progressively destroyed what remained of the Roman belief in the unity of civilization. This political disorder found expression in Machiavelli's Prince. In the absence of any guiding principle, politics becomes a naked struggle for power. The prince gives shrewd advice as to how to play this game successfully. What had happened in the great age of Greece happened again in Renaissance Italy. Traditional moral restraints disappeared because they were seen to be associated with superstition. The liberation from fetters made individuals energetic and creative, producing a rare fluorescence of genius. But the anarchy and treachery, which inevitably resulted from the decay of morals, made Italians collectively impotent, and they fell, like the Greeks, under the domination of nations less civilized than themselves, but not so destitute of social cohesion. The result, however, was less disastrous than in the case of Greece, because the newly powerful nations, with the exception of Spain, showed themselves as capable of great achievement as the Italians had been. From the 16th century onward, the history of European thought is dominated by the Reformation. The Reformation was a complex, many-sided movement and owed its success to a variety of causes. In the main, it was a revolt of the northern nations against the renewed dominion of Rome. Religion was the force that had subdued the north, but religion in Italy had decayed. The papacy remained as an institution and extracted a huge tribute from Germany and England. But these nations, which were still pious, could feel no reverence for the Borgias and Medicis, who professed to save souls from purgatory in return for cash which they squandered on luxury and immorality. National motives, economic motives, and moral motives all combined to strengthen the revolt against Rome. Moreover, the princes soon perceived that if the church in their territories became merely national, they would be able to dominate it, and would thus become much more powerful at home than they had been while sharing dominion with the Pope. For all these reasons, Luther's theological innovations were welcomed by rulers and peoples alike throughout the greater part of northern Europe. The Catholic Church was derived from three sources. Its sacred history was Jewish, its theology was Greek, its government and canon law were at least indirectly Roman. The Reformation rejected the Roman elements, softened the Greek elements, and greatly strengthened the Judaic elements. It thus cooperated with the nationalist forces which were undoing the work of social cohesion which had been effected first by the Roman Empire and then by the Roman Church. In Catholic doctrine, divine revelation did not end with the Scriptures, but continued from age to age through the medium of the Church, to which, therefore, it was the duty of the individual to submit his private opinions. Protestants, on the contrary, rejected the Church as a vehicle of revelation. Truth was to be sought only in the Bible, which each man could interpret for himself. If men differed in their interpretation, there was no divinely appointed authority to decide the dispute. In practice, the state claimed the right that had formerly belonged to the Church, but this was a usurpation. In Protestant theory, there should be no earthly intermediary between the soul and God. The effects of this change were momentous. Truth was no longer to be ascertained by consulting authority, but by inward meditation. There was a tendency, quickly developed, towards anarchism in politics, and in religion, towards mysticism, which had always fitted with difficulty into the framework of Catholic orthodoxy. There came to be not one Protestantism, but a multitude of sects. Not one philosophy opposed to scholasticism, but as many as there were philosophers. Not, as in the 13th century, one emperor opposed to the Pope, but a large number of heretical kings. The result, in thought, as in literature, was a continually deepening subjectivism, operating at first as a wholesome liberation from spiritual slavery, but advancing steadily towards a personal isolation inimical to social sanity. Modern philosophy begins with Descartes, whose fundamental certainty is the existence of himself and his thoughts, from which the external world is to be inferred. This was only the first stage in a development through Berkeley and Kant to Fichte, for whom everything is only an emanation of the ego. This was insanity, and from this extreme philosophy has been attempting ever since to escape into the world of everyday common sense. With subjectivism in philosophy, anarchism in politics goes hand in hand. Already, during Luther's lifetime, unwelcome and unacknowledged disciples had developed the doctrine of Anabaptism, which for a time dominated the city of Münster. The Anabaptists repudiated all law, since they held that the good man will be guided at every moment by the Holy Spirit, who cannot be bound by formulas. From this premise they arrive at communism and sexual promiscuity. They were therefore exterminated after a heroic resistance. But their doctrine in softened form spread to Holland, England, and America. Historically, it is the source of Quakerism. A fiercer form of anarchism, no longer connected with religion, arose in the 19th century. In Russia, in Spain, and to a lesser degree in Italy, it had considerable success, and to this day it remains a bugbear of the American immigration authorities. This modern form, though anti-religious, has still much of the spirit of early Protestantism. It differs mainly in directing against secular governments the hostility that Luther directed against popes. Subjectivity, once let loose, could not be confined within limits until it had run its course. In morals, the Protestant emphasis on the individual conscience was essentially anarchic. Habit and custom were so strong that except in occasional outbreaks, such as that of Münster, the disciples of individualism in ethics continued to act in a manner which was conventionally virtuous. But this was a precarious equilibrium. The 18th century cult of sensibility began to break it down. An act was admired not for its good consequences or for its conformity to a moral code, but for the emotion that inspired it. Out of this attitude developed the cult of the hero, as it is expressed by Carlyle and Nietzsche, and the Byronic cult of violent passion of no matter what kind. The Romantic movement, in art, in literature, and in politics, is bound up with this subjective way of judging men, not as members of a community, but as aesthetically delightful objects of contemplation. Tigers are more beautiful than sheep, but we prefer them behind bars. The typical romantic removes the bars and enjoys the magnificent leaps with which the tiger annihilates the sheep. He exhorts men to imagine themselves tigers, and when he succeeds, the results are not wholly pleasant. Against the more insane forms of subjectivism in modern times, there have been various reactions. First, a halfway compromise philosophy, the doctrine of liberalism, which attempted to assign the respective spheres of government and the individual. This begins in its modern form with Locke, who is as much opposed to enthusiasm, the individualism of the Anabaptists, as to absolute authority and blind subservience to tradition. A more thoroughgoing revolt leads to the doctrine of state worship, which assigns to the state the position that Catholicism gave to the Church, or even sometimes to God. Hobbes, Rousseau, and Hegel represent different phases of this theory, and their doctrines are embodied practically in Cromwell, Napoleon, and modern Germany. Communism, in theory, is far removed from such philosophies, but is driven in practice to a type of community very similar to that which results from state worship. Throughout this long development, from 600 BC to the present day, philosophers have been divided into those who wished to tighten social bonds and those who wished to relax them. With this difference, others have been associated. The disciplinarians have advocated some system of dogma, either old or new, and have therefore been compelled to be, in a greater or less degree, hostile to science, since their dogmas could not be proved empirically. They have almost invariably taught that happiness is not the good, but that nobility or heroism is to be preferred. They have had a sympathy with the irrational parts of human nature, since they have felt reason to be inimical to social cohesion. The libertarians, on the other hand, with the exception of the extreme anarchists, have tended to be scientific, utilitarian, rationalistic, hostile to violent passion, and enemies of all the more profound forms of religion. This conflict existed in Greece before the rise of what we recognize as philosophy, and is already quite explicit in the earliest Greek thought. In changing forms, it has persisted down to the present day, and no doubt will persist for many ages to come. It is clear that each party to this dispute, as to all that persist throughout long periods of time, is partly right and partly wrong. Social cohesion is a necessity, and mankind has never yet succeeded in enforcing cohesion by merely rational arguments. Every community is exposed to two opposite dangers: ossification through too much discipline and reverence for tradition on the one hand, on the other hand, dissolution or subjection to foreign conquest through the growth of an individualism and personal independence that makes cooperation impossible. In general, important civilizations start with a rigid and superstitious system, gradually relaxed, and leading, at a certain stage, to a period of brilliant genius, while the good of the old tradition remains and the evil inherent in its dissolution has not yet developed. But as the evil unfolds, it leads to anarchy, thence, inevitably, to a new tyranny, producing a new synthesis secured by a new system of dogma. The doctrine of liberalism is an attempt to escape from this endless oscillation. The essence of liberalism is an attempt to secure a social order not based on irrational dogma, and ensuring stability without involving more restraints than are necessary for the preservation of the community. Whether this attempt can succeed, only the future can determine. Book 1. Ancient Philosophy. Part 1. The Pre-Socratics. Chapter 1. The Rise of Greek Civilization. In all history, nothing is so surprising or so difficult to account for as the sudden rise of civilization in Greece. Much of what makes civilization had already existed for thousands of years in Egypt and in Mesopotamia, and had spread thence to neighboring countries. But certain elements had been lacking until the Greeks supplied them. What they achieved in art and literature is familiar to everybody, but what they did in the purely intellectual realm is even more exceptional. They invented mathematics and science and philosophy. Footnote. Arithmetic and some geometry existed among the Egyptians and Babylonians, but mainly in the form of rules of thumb. Deductive reasoning from general premises was a Greek innovation. End of footnote. They first wrote history as opposed to mere annals. They speculated freely about the nature of the world and the ends of life, without being bound in the fetters of any inherited orthodoxy. What occurred was so astonishing that until very recent times, men were content to gape and talk mystically about the Greek genius. It is possible, however, to understand the development of Greece in scientific terms, and it is well worthwhile to do so. Philosophy begins with Thales, who fortunately can be dated by the fact that he predicted an eclipse, which, according to the astronomers, occurred in the year 585 BC. Philosophy and science, which were not originally separate, were therefore born together at the beginning of the 6th century. What had been happening in Greece and neighboring countries before this time? Any answer must in part be conjectural, but archaeology, during the present century, has given us much more knowledge than was possessed by our grandfathers. The art of writing was invented in Egypt about the year 4000 BC, and in Babylonia not much later. In each country, writing began with the pictures of the objects intended. These pictures quickly became conventionalized, so that words were represented by ideograms, as they still are in China. In the course of thousands of years, this cumbrous system developed into alphabetic writing. The early development of civilization in Egypt and Mesopotamia was due to the Nile, the Tigris, and the Euphrates, which made agriculture very easy and very productive. The civilization was in many ways similar to that which the Spaniards found in Mexico and Peru. There was a divine king with despotic powers. In Egypt, he owned all the land. There was a polytheistic religion with a supreme god to whom the king had a specially intimate relation. There was a military aristocracy and also a priestly aristocracy. The latter was often able to encroach on the royal power if the king was weak or if he was engaged in a difficult war. The cultivators of the soil were serfs, belonging to the king, the aristocracy, or the priesthood. There was a considerable difference between Egyptian and Babylonian theology. The Egyptians were preoccupied with death and believed that the souls of the dead descend into the underworld, where they are judged by Osiris according to the manner of their life on earth. They thought that the soul would ultimately return to the body. This led to mummification and to the construction of splendid tombs. The pyramids were built by various kings at the end of the 4th millennium BC and the beginning of the 3rd. After this time, Egyptian civilization became more and more stereotyped, and religious conservatism made progress impossible. About 1800 BC, Egypt was conquered by Semites named Hyksos, who ruled the country for about 2 centuries. They left no permanent mark on Egypt, but their presence there must have helped to spread Egyptian civilization in Syria and Palestine. Babylonia had a more warlike development than Egypt. At first, the ruling race were not Semites, but Sumerians, whose origin is unknown. They invented cuneiform writing, which the conquering Semites took over from them. There was a period when there were various independent cities which fought with each other, but in the end, Babylon became supreme and established an empire. The gods of other cities became subordinate, and Marduk, the god of Babylon, acquired a position like that later held by Zeus in the Greek pantheon. The same sort of thing had happened in Egypt, but in a much earlier time. The religions of Egypt and Babylonia, like other ancient religions, were originally fertility cults. The earth was female, the sun male. The bull was usually regarded as an embodiment of male fertility, and bull gods were common. In Babylon, Ishtar, the earth goddess, was supreme among female divinities. Throughout Western Asia, the Great Mother was worshipped under various names. When Greek colonists in Asia Minor found temples to her, they named her Artemis and took over the existing cult. This is the origin of Diana of the Ephesians. Footnote. Diana was the Latin equivalent of Artemis. It is Artemis who is mentioned in the Greek Testament, where our translation speaks of Diana. End of footnote. Christianity transformed her into the Virgin Mary, and it was a council at Ephesus that legitimated the title Mother of God as applied to Our Lady. Where a religion was bound up with the government of an empire, political motives did much to transform its primitive features. A god or goddess became associated with the state and had to give not only an abundant harvest, but victory in war. A rich priestly caste elaborated the ritual and the theology and fitted together into a pantheon the several divinities of the component parts of the empire. Through association with government, the gods also became associated with morality. Lawgivers received their codes from a god, thus a breach of the law became an impiety. The oldest legal code still known is that of Hammurabi, king of Babylon, about 2100 BC. This code was asserted by the king to have been delivered to him by Marduk. The connection between religion and morality became continually closer throughout ancient times. Babylonian religion, unlike that of Egypt, was more concerned with prosperity in this world than with happiness in the next. Magic, divination, and astrology, though not peculiar to Babylonia, were more developed there than elsewhere, and it was chiefly through Babylon that they acquired their hold on later antiquity. From Babylon come some things that belong to science, the division of the day into 24 hours, and of the circle into 360 degrees. Also, the discovery of a cycle in eclipses, which enabled lunar eclipses to be predicted with certainty and solar eclipses with some probability. This Babylonian knowledge, as we shall see, was acquired by Thales. The civilizations of Egypt and Mesopotamia were agricultural, and those of surrounding nations at first were pastoral. A new element came with the development of commerce, which was at first almost entirely maritime. Weapons, until about 1000 BC, were made of bronze, and nations which did not have the necessary metals on their own territory were obliged to obtain them by trade or piracy. Piracy was a temporary expedient, and where social and political conditions were fairly stable, commerce was found to be more profitable. In commerce, the island of Crete seems to have been the pioneer. For about 11 centuries, say from 2500 BC to 1400 BC, an artistically advanced culture called the Minoan existed in Crete. what survives of Cretan art gives an impression of cheerfulness and almost decadent luxury, very different from the terrifying gloom of Egyptian temples. Of this important civilization, almost nothing was known until the excavations of Sir Arthur Evans and others. It was a maritime civilization, in close touch with Egypt, except during the time of the Hyksos. From Egyptian pictures, it is evident that the very considerable commerce between Egypt and Crete was carried on by Cretan sailors. This commerce reached its maximum about 1500 BC. The Cretan religion appears to have had many affinities with the religions of Syria and Asia Minor, but in art there was more affinity with Egypt, though Cretan art was very original and amazingly full of life. The center of the Cretan civilization was the so-called Palace of Minos at Knossos, of which memories lingered in the traditions of classical Greece. The palaces of Crete were very magnificent, but were destroyed about the end of the 14th century BC, probably by invaders from Greece. The chronology of Cretan history is derived from Egyptian objects found in Crete and Cretan objects found in Egypt. Throughout, our knowledge is dependent on archaeological evidence. The Cretans worshipped a goddess, or perhaps several goddesses. The most indubitable goddess was the mistress of animals, who was a huntress and probably the source of the classical Artemis. Footnote. She has a male twin or consort, the master of animals, but he is less prominent. It was at a later date that Artemis was identified with the great mother of Asia Minor. End of footnote. She or another was also a mother. The only male deity, apart from the master of animals, is her young son. There is some evidence of belief in an afterlife, in which, as in Egyptian belief, deeds on earth receive reward or retribution. But on the whole, the Cretans appear, from their art, to have been cheerful people, not much oppressed by gloomy superstitions. They were fond of bullfights, at which female as well as male toreadors performed amazing acrobatic feats. The bullfights were religious celebrations, and Sir Arthur Evans thinks that the performers belonged to the highest nobility. The surviving pictures are full of movement and realism. The Cretans had a linear script, but it has not been deciphered. At home they were peaceful, and their cities were unwalled. No doubt they were defended by sea power. Before the destruction of the Minoan culture, it spread, about 1600 BC, to the mainland of Greece, where it survived through gradual stages of degeneration until about 900 BC. This mainland civilization is called the Mycenaean. It is known through the tombs of kings, and also through fortresses on hilltops, which show more fear of war than had existed in Crete. Both tombs and fortresses remained to impress the imagination of classical Greece. The older art products in the palaces are either actually of Cretan workmanship, or closely akin to those of Crete. The Mycenaean civilization, seen through a haze of legend, is that which is depicted in Homer. There is much uncertainty concerning the Mycenaeans. Did they owe their civilization to being conquered by the Cretans? Did they speak Greek, or were they an earlier indigenous race? No certain answer to these questions is possible, but on the whole it seems probable that they were conquerors who spoke Greek, and that at least the aristocracy consisted of fair-haired invaders from the north who brought the Greek language with them. The Greeks came to Greece in three successive waves, first the Ionians, then the Achaeans, and last the Dorians. The Ionians appear, though conquerors, to have adopted the Cretan civilization pretty completely, as later the Romans adopted the civilization of Greece. But the Ionians were disturbed and largely dispossessed by their successors, the Achaeans. The Achaeans are known, from the Hittite tablets found at Borgas Koi, to have had a large organized empire in the 14th century BC. The Mycenaean civilization, which had been weakened by the warfare of the Ionians and Achaeans, was practically destroyed by the Dorians, the last Greek invaders. Whereas previous invaders had largely adopted the Minoan religion, the Dorians retained the original Indo-European religion of their ancestors. The religion of Mycenaean times, however, lingered on, especially in the lower classes, and the religion of classical Greece was a blend of the two. Although the above account seems probable, it must be remembered that we do not know whether the Mycenaeans were Greeks or not. What we do know is that their civilization decayed, that about the time when it ended, iron superseded bronze, and that for some time sea supremacy passed to the Phoenicians. Both during the later part of the Mycenaean Age and after its end, some of the invaders settled down and became agriculturists, while some pushed on, first into the islands in Asia Minor, then into Sicily and southern Italy, where they founded cities that lived by maritime commerce. It was in these maritime cities that the Greeks first made qualitatively new contributions to civilization. The supremacy of Athens came later and was equally associated, when it came, with naval power. The mainland of Greece is mountainous and largely infertile, but there are many fertile valleys with easy access to the sea, but cut off by the mountains from easy land communication with each other. In these valleys, little separate communities grew up, living by agriculture and centering round a town, generally close to the sea. In such circumstances, it was natural that as soon as the population of any community grew too great for its internal resources, those who could not live on the land should take to seafaring. The cities of the mainland founded colonies, often in places where it was much easier to find subsistence than it had been at home. Thus, in the earliest historical period, the Greeks of Asia Minor, Sicily, and Italy were much richer than those of the Greek mainland. The social system was very different in different parts of Greece. In Sparta, a small aristocracy subsisted on the labor of oppressed serfs of a different race. In the poorer agricultural regions, the population consisted mainly of farmers cultivating their own land with the help of their families. But where commerce and industry flourished, the free citizens grew rich by the employment of slaves, male in the mines, female in the textile industry. These slaves were, in Ionia, of the surrounding barbarian population, and were, as a rule, first acquired in war. With increasing wealth went increasing isolation of respectable women, who in later times had little part in the civilized aspects of Greek life, except in Sparta. There was a very general development, first from monarchy to aristocracy, then to an alternation of tyranny and democracy. The kings were not absolute, like those of Egypt and Babylonia. They were advised by a council of elders, and could not transgress custom with impunity. Tyranny did not mean necessarily bad government, but only the rule of a man whose claim to power was not hereditary. Democracy meant government by all the citizens, among whom slaves and women were not included. The early tyrants, like the Medici, acquired their power through being the richest members of their respective plutocracies. Often, the source of their wealth was the ownership of gold and silver mines, made the more profitable by the new institution of coinage, which came from the kingdom of Lydia, adjacent to Ionia. Coinage seems to have been invented shortly before 700 BC. One of the most important results to the Greeks of commerce or piracy, at first the two are scarcely distinct, was the acquisition of the art of writing. Although writing had existed for thousands of years in Egypt and Babylonia, and the Minoan Cretans had a script which has not been deciphered, there is no conclusive evidence that the Greeks knew how to write until about the 10th century BC. They learnt the art from the Phoenicians, who, like the other inhabitants of Syria, were exposed to both Egyptian and Babylonian influences, and who held the supremacy in maritime commerce until the rise of the Greek cities of Ionia, Italy, and Sicily. In the 14th century, writing to Akhenaten, the heretic king of Egypt, Syrians still used the Babylonian cuneiform. But Hiram of Tyre, 969-936, used the Phoenician alphabet, which probably developed out of the Egyptian script. The Egyptians used at first a pure picture writing. Gradually, the pictures, much conventionalized, came to represent syllables, the first syllables of the names of the things pictured, and at last single letters on the principle of A was an archer who shot at a frog. Footnote. For instance, Gimel, the third letter of the Hebrew alphabet, means camel, and the sign for it is a conventionalized picture of a camel. End of footnote. This last step, which was not taken with any completeness by the Egyptians themselves, but by the Phoenicians, gave the alphabet with all its advantages. The Greeks, borrowing from the Phoenicians, altered the alphabet to suit their language and made the important innovation of adding vowels instead of having only consonants. There can be no doubt that the acquisition of this convenient method of writing greatly hastened the rise of Greek civilization. The first notable product of the Hellenic civilization was Homer. Everything about Homer is conjectural, but the best opinion seems to be that he was a series of poets rather than an individual. Probably the Iliad and the Odyssey between them took about 200 years to complete, some say from 750 to 550 BC, while others hold that Homer was nearly complete at the end of the 8th century. The Homeric poems in their present form were brought to Athens by Pisistratus, who reigned, with intermissions, from 560 to 527 BC. From his time onward, the Athenian youth learnt Homer by heart, and this was the most important part of their education. In some parts of Greece, notably in Sparta, Homer had not the same prestige until a later date. The Homeric poems, like the courtly romances of the later Middle Ages, represent the point of view of a civilized aristocracy, which ignores, as plebeian, various superstitions that are still rampant among the populace. In much later times, many of these superstitions rose again to the light of day. Guided by anthropology, modern writers have come to the conclusion that Homer, so far from being primitive, was an expurgator, a kind of 18th-century rationalizer of ancient myths, holding up an upper-class ideal of urbane enlightenment. The Olympian gods, who represent religion in Homer, were not the only objects of worship among the Greeks, either in his time or later. There were other darker and more savage elements in popular religion, which were kept at bay by the Greek intellect at its best, but lay in wait to pounce in moments of weakness or terror. In the time of decadence, beliefs which Homer had discarded proved to have persisted half-buried throughout the classical period. This fact explains many things that would otherwise seem inconsistent and surprising. Primitive religion everywhere was tribal rather than personal. Certain rites were performed which were intended by sympathetic magic to further the interests of the tribe, especially in respect of fertility, vegetable, animal, and human. The winter solstice was a time when the sun had to be encouraged not to go on diminishing in strength. Spring and harvest also called for appropriate ceremonies. These were often such as to generate a great collective excitement, in which individuals lost their sense of separateness and felt themselves at one with the whole tribe. All over the world, at a certain stage of religious evolution, sacred animals and human beings were ceremonially killed and eaten. In different regions, this stage occurred at very different dates. Human sacrifice usually lasted longer than the sacrificial eating of human victims. In Greece, it was not yet extinct at the beginning of historical times. Fertility rites without such cruel aspects were common throughout Greece. The Eleusinian mysteries, in particular, were essentially agricultural in their symbolism. It must be admitted that religion in Homer is not very religious. The gods are completely human, differing from men only in being immortal and possessed of superhuman powers. Morally, there is nothing to be said for them, and it is difficult to see how they can have inspired much awe. In some passages, supposed to be late, they are treated with Voltairean irreverence. Such genuine religious feeling as is to be found in Homer is less concerned with the gods of Olympus than with more shadowy beings, such as fate or necessity or destiny, to whom even Zeus is subject. Fate exercised a great influence on all Greek thought, and perhaps was one of the sources from which science derived the belief in natural law. The Homeric gods were the gods of a conquering aristocracy, not the useful fertility gods of those who actually tilled the soil. As Gilbert Murray says, "The gods of most nations claim to have created the world. The Olympians made no such claim. The most they ever did was to conquer it. And when they have conquered their kingdoms, what do they do? Do they attend to the government? Do they promote agriculture? Do they practice trades and industries? Not a bit of it. Why should they do any honest work? They find it easier to live on the revenues and blast with thunderbolts the people who do not pay. They are conquering chieftains, royal buccaneers. They fight and feast and play and make music. They drink deep and roar with laughter at the lame smith who waits on them. They are never afraid, except of their own king. They never tell lies, except in love and war. Homer's human heroes, equally, are not very well behaved. The leading family is the House of Pelops, but it did not succeed in setting a pattern of happy family life. Tantalos, the Asiatic founder of the dynasty, began its career by a direct offense against the gods, some said by trying to cheat them into eating human flesh, that of his own son, Pelops. Pelops, having been miraculously restored to life, offended in his turn. He won his famous chariot race against Onomaus, king of Pisa, by the connivance of the latter's charioteer, Myrtilus, and then got rid of his confederate, whom he had promised to reward, by flinging him into the sea. The curse descended to his sons, Atreus and Thyestes, in the form of what the Greeks called ate, a strong, if not actually irresistible, impulse to crime. Thyestes corrupted his brother's wife, and thereby managed to steal the luck of the family, the famous golden-fleeced ram. Atreus, in turn, secured his brother's banishment, and recalling him under pretext of a reconciliation, feasted him on the flesh of his own children. The curse was now inherited by Atreus's son Agamemnon, who offended Artemis by killing a sacred stag, sacrificed his own daughter Iphigenia to appease the goddess and obtain a safe passage to Troy for his fleet, and was in turn murdered by his faithless wife Clytemnestra and her paramour Aegisthus, a surviving son of Thyestes. Orestes, Agamemnon's son, in turn avenged his father by killing his mother and Aegisthus. Homer, as a finished achievement, was a product of Ionia, that is, of a part of Hellenic Asia Minor and the adjacent islands. Sometime during the 6th century at latest, the Homeric poems became fixed in their present form. It was also during this century that Greek science and philosophy and mathematics began. At the same time, events of fundamental importance were happening in other parts of the world. Confucius, Buddha, and Zoroaster, if they existed, probably belong to the same century. Footnote. Zoroaster's date, however, is very conjectural. Some place it as early as 1000 BC. End of footnote. In the middle of the century, the Persian Empire was established by Cyrus. Towards its close, the Greek cities of Ionia, to which the Persians had allowed a limited autonomy, made a fruitless rebellion, which was put down by Darius, and their best men became exiles. Several of the philosophers of this period were refugees, who wandered from city to city in the still unenslaved parts of the Hellenic world, spreading the civilization that until then had been mainly confined to Ionia. They were kindly treated in their wanderings. Xenophanes, who flourished in the later part of the 6th century and who was one of the refugees, says, "This is the sort of thing we should say by the fireside in the winter time, as we lie on soft couches after a good meal, drinking sweet wine and crunching chickpeas. Of what country are you? And how old are you, good sir? And how old were you when the Mede appeared?" The rest of Greece succeeded in preserving its independence at the battles of Salamis and Plataea, after which Ionia was liberated for a time. Footnote. As a result of the defeat of Athens by Sparta, the Persians regained the whole coast of Asia Minor, to which their right was acknowledged in the Peace of Antalcidas, 387-86 BC. About 50 years later, they were incorporated in Alexander's empire. End of footnote. Greece was divided into a large number of small independent states, each consisting of a city with some agricultural territory surrounding it. The level of civilization was very different in different parts of the Greek world, and only a minority of cities contributed to the total of Hellenic achievement. Sparta, of which I shall have much to say later, was important in a military sense, but not culturally. Corinth was rich and prosperous, a great commercial center, but not prolific in great men. Then there were purely agricultural, rural communities, such as the proverbial Arcadia, which townsmen imagined to be idyllic, but which really was full of ancient barbaric horrors. The inhabitants worshipped Pan, and had a multitude of fertility cults, in which often a mere square pillar did duty in place of a statue of the god. The goat was the symbol of fertility, because the peasants were too poor to possess bulls. When food was scarce, the statue of Pan was beaten. Similar things are still done in remote Chinese villages. There was a clan of supposed werewolves, associated probably with human sacrifice and cannibalism. It was thought that whoever tasted the flesh of a sacrificed human victim became a werewolf. There was a cave sacred to Zeus Lycaios, the wolf Zeus. In this cave, no one had a shadow, and whoever entered it died within a year. All this superstition was still flourishing in classical times. Pan, whose original name was Paon, meaning the feeder or shepherd, acquired his better-known title, interpreted as meaning the all-god, when his worship was adopted by Athens in the 5th century, after the Persian War. There was, however, in ancient Greece, much that we can feel to have been religion as we understand the term. This was connected not with the Olympians, but with Dionysus, or Bacchus, whom we think of most naturally as the somewhat disreputable god of wine and drunkenness. The way in which, out of his worship, there arose a profound mysticism, which greatly influenced many of the philosophers, and even had a part in shaping Christian theology, is very remarkable, and must be understood by anyone who wishes to study the development of Greek thought. Dionysus, or Bacchus, was originally a Thracian god. The Thracians were very much less civilized than the Greeks, who regarded them as barbarians. Like all primitive agriculturists, they had fertility cults, and a god who promoted fertility. His name was Bacchus. It was never quite clear whether Bacchus had the shape of a man or of a bull. When they discovered how to make beer, they thought intoxication divine, and gave honor to Bacchus. When later they came to know the vine, and to learn to drink wine, they thought even better of him. His functions in promoting fertility in general became somewhat subordinate to his functions in relation to the grape and the divine madness produced by wine. At what date his worship migrated from Thrace to Greece is not known, but it seems to have been just before the beginning of historical times. The cult of Bacchus was met with hostility by the Orthodox, but nevertheless it established itself. It contained many barbaric elements, such as tearing wild animals to pieces and eating the whole of them raw. It had a curious element of feminism. Respectable matrons and maids in large companies would spend whole nights on the bare hills in dances which stimulated ecstasy and in an intoxication perhaps partly alcoholic but mainly mystical. Husbands found the practice annoying, but did not dare to oppose religion. Both the beauty and the savagery of the cult are set forth in the Bacchae of Euripides. The success of Bacchus in Greece is not surprising. Like all communities that have been civilized quickly, the Greeks, or at least a certain proportion of them, developed a love of the primitive, and a hankering after a more instinctive and passionate way of life than that sanctioned by current morals. To the man or woman who, by compulsion, is more civilized in behavior than in feeling, rationality is irksome, and virtue is felt as a burden and a slavery. This leads to a reaction in thought, in feeling, and in conduct. It is the reaction in thought that will specially concern us, but something must first be said about the reaction in feeling and conduct. The civilized man is distinguished from the savage merely by prudence, or, to use a slightly wider term, forethought. He is willing to endure present pains for the sake of future pleasures, even if the future pleasures are rather distant. This habit began to be important with the rise of agriculture. No animal and no savage would work in the spring in order to have food next winter, except for a few purely instinctive forms of action, such as bees making honey or squirrels burying nuts. In these cases, there is no forethought. There is a direct impulse to an act which, to the human spectator, is obviously going to prove useful later on. True forethought only arises when a man does something towards which no impulse urges him, because his reason tells him that he will profit by it at some future date. Hunting requires no forethought, because it is pleasurable, but tilling the soil is labor, and cannot be done from spontaneous impulse. Civilization checks impulse not only through forethought, which is a self-administered check, but also through law, custom, and religion. This check it inherits from barbarism, but it makes it less instinctive and more systematic. Certain acts are labeled criminal and are punished. Certain others, though not punished by law, are labelled wicked, and expose those who are guilty of them to social disapproval. The institution of private property brings with it the subjection of women, and usually the creation of a slave class. On the one hand, the purposes of the community are enforced upon the individual, and on the other hand, the individual, having acquired the habit of viewing his life as a whole, increasingly sacrifices his present to his future. It is evident that this process can be carried too far, as it is, for instance, by the miser. But without going to such extremes, prudence may easily involve the loss of some of the best things in life. The worshipper of Bacchus reacts against prudence. In intoxication, physical or spiritual, he recovers an intensity of feeling which prudence had destroyed. He finds the world full of delight and beauty, and his imagination is suddenly liberated from the prison of everyday preoccupations. The Bacchic ritual produced what was called enthusiasm, which means, etymologically, having the god enter into the worshipper, who believed that he became one with the god. Much of what is greatest in human achievement involves some element of intoxication. Footnote, I mean mental intoxication, not intoxication by alcohol. End of footnote. Some sweeping away of prudence by passion. Without the Bacchic element, life would be uninteresting. With it, it is dangerous. Prudence versus passion is a conflict that runs through history. It is not a conflict in which we ought to side wholly with either party. In the sphere of thought, sober civilization is roughly synonymous with science. But science, unadulterated, is not satisfying. Men need also passion and art and religion. Science may set limits to knowledge, but should not set limits to imagination. Among Greek philosophers, as among those of later times, there were those who were primarily scientific and those who were primarily religious. The latter owed much, directly or indirectly, to the religion of Bacchus. This applies especially to Plato, and through him to those later developments which were ultimately embodied in Christian theology. The worship of Bacchus in its original form was savage, and in many ways repulsive. It was not in this form that it influenced the philosophers, but in the spiritualized form attributed to Orpheus, which was ascetic and substituted mental for physical intoxication. Orpheus is a dim but interesting figure. Some hold that he was an actual man, others that he was a god or an imaginary hero. Traditionally, he came from Thrace, like Bacchus, but it seems more probable that he, or the movement associated with his name, came from Crete. It is certain that Orphic doctrines contain much that seems to have its first source in Egypt, and it was chiefly through Crete that Egypt influenced Greece. Orpheus is said to have been a reformer who was torn to pieces by frenzied maenads actuated by Bacchic orthodoxy. His addiction to music is not so prominent in the older forms of the legend as it became later. Primarily, he was a priest and a philosopher. Whatever may have been the teaching of Orpheus, if he existed, the teaching of the Orphics is well known. They believed in the transmigration of souls. They taught that the soul hereafter might achieve eternal bliss or suffer eternal or temporary torment according to its way of life here on earth. They aimed at becoming pure, partly by ceremonies of purification, partly by avoiding certain kinds of contamination. The most orthodox among them abstained from animal food, except on ritual occasions when they ate it sacramentally. Man, they held, is partly of earth, partly of heaven. By a pure life, the heavenly part is increased and the earthly part diminished. In the end, a man may become one with Bacchus and is called a Bacchus. There was an elaborate theology, according to which Bacchus was twice born, once of his mother, Semele, and once from the thigh of his father, Zeus. There are many forms of the Bacchus myth. In one of them, Bacchus is the son of Zeus and Persephone. While still a boy, he is torn to pieces by Titans, who eat his flesh, all but the heart. Some say that the heart was given by Zeus to Semele, others that Zeus swallowed it. In either case, it gave rise to the second birth of Bacchus. The tearing of a wild animal and the devouring of its raw flesh by Bacchae was supposed to reenact the tearing and eating of Bacchus by the Titans, and the animal, in some sense, was an incarnation of the god. The Titans were earthborn, but after eating the god, they had a spark of divinity. So man is partly of earth, partly divine, and Bacchic rites sought to make him more nearly completely divine. Euripides puts a confession into the mouth of an Orphic priest, which is instructive. Footnote. The verse translations in this chapter are by Professor Gilbert Murray. End of footnote. Lord of Europa's Tyrian line, Zeus-born, who holdest at thy feet the hundred citadels of Crete, I seek to thee from that dim shrine, roofed by the quick and carven beam, by Calib steel and wild bull's blood, in flawless joints of cypress wood made steadfast. There in one pure stream my days have run. The servant I, initiate of Idaean Jove, where midnight Zagreus roves, I rove. I have endured his thunder cry, fulfilled his red and bleeding feasts, held the great mother's mountain flame. I am set free and named by name a Bacchus of the mailed priests. Robed in pure white, I have borne me clean from man's vile birth and coffined clay, and exiled from my lips alway touch of all meat where life hath been. Footnotes. Idaean Jove. Mystically identified with Bacchus. Zagreus. One of the many names of Bacchus. End of footnotes. Orphic tablets have been found in tombs, giving instructions to the soul of the dead person as to how to find his way in the next world, and what to say in order to prove himself worthy of salvation. They are broken and incomplete. The most nearly complete, the Petelia tablet, is as follows. Thou shalt find on the left of the house of Hades a wellspring, and by the side thereof standing a white cypress. To this wellspring approach not near, but thou shalt find another by the lake of memory, cold water flowing forth, and there are guardians before it.